pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Mahendra Singhal to you. I first met him last February when attending a Hindu awareness seminar he was conducting at the Midwest Center for Mission in Chicago. Dr. Singhal holds degrees in math, the sciences, education, has a PhD in mathematics. He is a convert to the Christian faith from Hinduism, knows it very well from the inside, being born in India and in Hinduism and reared in it. And he is especially devoted to reaching Hindus with the gospel of Christ. I won't rehearse everything printed in your convocation brochure, but would mention that just this past July, I believe, Dr. Singhal had been invited to Hawaii to meet with leading international evangelists to devise strategies for reaching Hindus in the United States. Then also more recently, earlier this month, due to the spreading influence of the New Age movement in France, he was over there assisting missionaries and pastors to be better equipped for encountering it. With 1/7 of the world's population being adherents of Hinduism, and with related cults that are espousing its tenets everywhere, expanding their efforts, we're certainly very aware, Dr. Singhal, that your being with us this afternoon is most timely, and we're very pleased that you could work it into your schedule. And so, like Cornelius said, we are all here gathered to hear what you have to say, and we know we will benefit from your background and your expertise in especially in the New Age movement as you address us this afternoon. So welcome.
I'm, of course, very happy to be here. I'll try to speak rather slowly for two reasons. Most people have a little difficulty with my beautiful Indian, British, and American accent, and I don't know at which point it changes. And number two, I'm trying to cultivate the American way of speaking, especially as it applies to the Midwest. And I've noticed that people here in the Midwest speak rather slowly, and so I'll try to imitate that good Midwest way of speech. I'm privileged to be here, of course, speaking to a distinguished seminary faculty, and from what I gather from Professor Kapiski, it's really an honor to be here at the Faculty Forum of Concordia Seminary. What I share with you tonight, this afternoon, I hope would at least give you a broader picture of the so-called New Age movement. With the constraint of time, I'm afraid we can't go into too many details for obvious reasons. So if you'll allow me, gentlemen, I'll paint a picture with broad strokes and hope and pray that picture will at least bring you closer to an understanding of the focus and the direction in which the New Age movement seems to be going. The New Age movement, first of all, is not one concentrated movement. One of the most difficult things as we try to unravel the mystery of this movement is to find out where it began and who really is behind it. It seems to me, from my research, if I may, that there are several groups, autonomous, independent groups, that have been working independently of each other for years. all focusing almost in the same direction. And now in the last year or so, it seems that an effort is being made to bring these groups together. And the word that is used within the New Age movement is the networking. That if we can establish some kind of networking among these different groups with different motivation, with different background, but with similar focus, then the movement begins to take on an ominous shape and becomes a little more critical than if it would remain confined to several independent groups. The main thrust of each of these independent groups is that these groups normally advocate approaching life in ways which are different from the established norms. And these ways are designed to affect our educational system, our religious system, and of course the national economics and politics. The New Age, the groups, irrespective of where they originated from, have a different way to responding to life. They have a different idea about how change and progress in society can be brought about. They have a different explanation of nature, life, and history. And they are trying to develop a different structure of economics, education, society, and family. Now, there are some people who are saying that there is a conspiracy afoot, a deliberate, organized, ongoing plan to change the world. I somehow don't find enough validation to substantiate that statement. I believe there is a rise and influence of the New Age phenomenon, but I don't think we can label it a conspiracy, at least not at this point. There are some who think that there is a New World Order being advocated, and this New World Order will eventually link up and change society. That, unfortunately, seems to be happening. The words like network and cultural alignment are being used and are being tried to link up the various schools that are active right now. Let me first of all take you through some of the groups that are already existing. There is an there is a society in America established by a man called Rudolf Steiner, an Australian philosopher, scientist, and artist. This society proceeds from the assumption that there is a spiritual world comprehensible to pure thinking, but is not accessible to people with impure thinking. It can be accessible to higher faculties of knowledge latent in every man and woman. Dr. Steiner believes that therefore, in order for anyone to comprehend the spiritual realities, he must first elevate himself and reach into his higher faculties if they exist. And then there is a little ambiguity in the argument, because what Steiner does not say is that these higher faculties, at what point do they become pure thinking? And he leaves that question unanswered. In other words, his presupposition is that you cannot comprehend God with an impure mind. But you can comprehend God if you have spent a great deal of time with available higher faculty of thinking. Now, is he therefore saying that the higher faculty of thinking is equivalent to pure thinking? And people who follow his society spend a great deal of time trying to develop what he would call the higher thinking. And there are a number of camps, and people are beginning to try different forms of music, farming, education, because he believes that these avenues can lead to higher faculties of knowledge, which can then lead to some kind of spiritual realization. Now, if you read Steiner's books, one thing that amazed me about Steiner is that in no place does he say what eventually is supposed to happen when you do reach that stage of spiritual enlightenment. That part is somehow foggy in the whole development. There's a group called the Church Universal and Triumphant. The prophet is a lady by the name of Elizabeth Clare, and she's called as Guruma. She's considered the messenger of the ascended masters to initiate students in cosmic law. Now, one of the things I'd like to submit to you, gentlemen, is that sometimes when I read these words, even though I may not be able to pronounce some of them, and pardon me for that, they sound very good. They sound very intellectual. But when you really try to analyze those, you discover that they are simply words that have been put together to sound good, but they really don't have any substance to it. Well, this lady says that is the exploration, initiate the students in cosmic law through fostering the exploration of reality and the defining of individual self-mastery. Let me repeat that. Initiate students in cosmic law, whatever that means, through fostering the exploration of reality and the defining of individual self-mastery. They established a university in Los Angeles called Summit University. And there are study groups that teach students to disseminate the ancient wisdom. This Guruma teaches that Earth is in a revolution of higher consciousness, in which heightened awareness will make initiated students recognize the fact that life and God and persons are energy. The teaching is the way to enlightenment through contact with the inner self, which is Christ, the individual reality that knows itself as God. And when you reach that glorious stage, this discovery will lead to a world government through self-government. Now, of course, this raises all kinds of questions. How can a person develop an awareness of Christ and also discover that the Christ he finds within himself is nothing else than a form of energy? And at that point of consciousness, you begin the art of self-mastery. There's a group again in California, that is trying to establish a verbal contact with animals. And they believe that by training yourself and putting yourself in, so to speak, the shoes of a dog, one can begin to communicate with a dog. And once you reach that stage of communication with a dog, you also will begin to reach the stage of communicating with your inner self. And so people are rushing to this center to learn how to communicate with a dog. And apparently the experiment is very highly successful because they have a big following. There is a foundation in Scotland, and it has about 200 members, and its members is called the Findhorn Foundation, and its members are trained to communicate not with dogs but with plants. The foundation is based on the belief that humanity approaches an evolutionary expansion of consciousness which will create new patterns of civilization for all of society. And so in order to communicate with the plants, the members are taught how to extend their hands or feet, I mean hand and feet, yes, to resemble a plant. And then you stand in a kind of a mode in front of a plant, so when the plant sees you, it is not intimidated by you, and you resemble a plant as far as is humanly possible. And at that stage, if you stay there like this for a certain amount of time, you may, as the foundation says, that humans would approach an evolutionary expansion of consciousness, which will create new patterns of civilization for all of society. That is, we'll all begin to understand what plants are saying. And I guess that would be an evolutionary expansion of consciousness. The Lucy's Trust is another group which is a not-for-profit, non-political, tax-exempt World Service Corporation. This school is a correspondence school which presents courses of study and meditation in Eastern philosophy. And their center of attention is they believe in triangles. They teach their students to concentrate on triangles. And the triangles serve to establish a global network of light and goodwill through the power of thought and invocation. There is a group in Illinois, and I have absolutely no association with it, but they are developing a community which is evolving into an ecumenical center of New Age thinking, where all the many different resources for personal and social transformation will be available in a mutually supportive and constructive environment. This group provides experiential citizenship training in STEL to assist persons in achieving initiation into the great plan of the Brotherhoods. It's a channel for members within the organization and in the future the city on the island in the Pacific called Philadelphia. They believe that in the 1990s, 250,000 people will come to this particular commune. There is a Unity in Diversity Council, which describes itself as a worldwide coordinating body of organizations and individuals fostering the emergence of a new universal person and civilization based on unity and diversity among all peoples. Well, all these groups, and there are many more, what are they really saying? What are they really saying? And where the danger is? Number one, and I have four points that I like to make on what all these groups are saying, if you want to reduce it all down to common denominator. First of all, what is the authority of each of these groups? Each of these groups, irrespective of whether you learn to communicate with plants or with dogs, or look in yourself and find Christ, they all believe in listening to the teachings of someone who claims to be a master. In other words, all these groups, without exception, at least I haven't come across an exception, are being raised by one individual who calls himself an ascended master. And this person, for whatever reason, is apparently accepted as the authority for that particular group. And one of the things that they do is that they believe that only the inner group in that particular setting can find the special truth. It cannot be made available to the people who are outside the circle. Most of these ascended masters have had some exposure to Hindu philosophy. Almost all of them, I don't want to say all of them because there might be one who says, I've never been to Hindu philosophy, but from the groups that I have tried to put together, it seems that they've all had some exposure to Hindu philosophy. And in most cases, they have spent a great deal of time either studying Hinduism or having lived in India. The intentions of each of these groups is to help, as at least that's what they proclaim, is to help an individual who becomes an initiate or a member of the group to find within himself help for himself. Is self-motivation. In each of the situations, they are trying to raise the consciousness level of the individual. And in most cases, they are saying that as the consciousness level is raised of the individual member, the chances are he'll begin to evolve towards some kind of a spiritual mastery or spiritualism in his life. Its value system is dangerous. The right and wrong become relative. There is no absolute mode of ethics in any of the systems. What the master says decides the rightness or the wrongness of a particular situation. In most groups, the Christian concept of sin is ignored. They have absolutely no question of or even awareness of the sin factor. They advocate, and this is where I believe it becomes dangerous, an almost individual approach to different actions. Right and wrong ought to be decided on how the ascended master feels about the situation rather than according to any pre-established absolute criteria. For instance, in the commune that was established in Oregon, I'm sure you are familiar with it, and I'm glad that the American government helped that man to leave this country, who was a shame to India, if not to the States. You know who I'm talking about, Maharishi, Bhagwan or something or the other he was called. In his particular center, Rajneeshpuram in Oregon, in his center, people were allowed to do what they wanted to do. And I'm sure you've read stories of that. that the people who rush to join that particular ashram had the freedom to drink, to indulge their human appetites in whatever form they wanted to. The only criteria was, of course, that they had to sign over all their wealth to the ashram. They were not free in that area only. They were free in everything else. The lifestyle is also very closely regimented. That is, the local setting decides what people would look like, what they would eat, how they would dress. Even the roles of men, women and children in some cases is regimented by the Ascended Master. In some groups, the Ascended Masters have become descended masters for some reason. They were outcasts, they were thrown out. And then they waited not on the collective wisdom of the group, but in one case, which was very, very interesting, they all just decided that they'll wait and carry on till somebody came to them and said, I am now the new guru and you ought to follow me. And that's exactly what happened. A young boy of 15 arrived on the scene from India and claimed that he was the new guru who had been sent to lead this particular group, and he was accepted as the new guru. Till this new guru fell in love with a 30-year-old American secretary and eloped with her, and now the group is waiting again for the next ascended master to arrive on the scene. And people have not rushed from there, they're still there, and I'm not making light of this, this is exactly what I have discovered. The group, incidentally, is located in New Jersey. The problem I have with the New Age movement is this, theologically speaking. Attempts, it seems to me, are being made on a larger scene to synthesize the Christian belief system with Hinduism. Now, the interesting thing is that in most cases, when they talk about the highest level of consciousness, they somehow see Christ at that level. Though they also add very quickly to that, that Christ is one of the reincarnations, not the only reincarnation. Some groups believe that there are other reincarnations at the higher level of consciousness. Krishna is one of them. Some people have added Gandhi to that list. And I don't know who else. The second dangerous thing is that they are advocating very strongly that each person is God. Divinity is within each person. And if you explore yourself for any length of time, you're likely to discover the resident God within you. Now, if you go to Hindu philosophy, as I'm sure some of you might have, you'll discover that God in Hinduism is really not defined. To put it in the Hindu context, Hinduism, we call it a pantheistic religion, but really in the final shape, Hinduism makes no attempt to define God. I call it a speculative religion in that sense. Because the Hindu philosophy very simply asserts that God is not definable. I mean, because if you begin to define something that is non-definable, he ceases to be non-definable. And therefore God cannot be defined. And you can't have a picture of God because God is then would be limited. And God cannot be limited. And therefore there is absolutely no picture of God in Hinduism, and the New Age movement is leading people to almost the same premise, that when you look in yourself, within yourself, you'll find God, who is the Hindu God who cannot be defined. And then a very crude picture of Christ is presented, primarily perhaps to appease Christian mind, the Christian people who are rushing into joining these movements. My problem is that if Hindus could find God within themselves, and they've been doing it for the past 5,000 years, and sages have lived on the Himalayan mountains and all over India trying to locate this God by great deal of meditation and thinking, I'd like to meet one of those people and see what he actually found. And it looks like I'm making fun of Hindu philosophers or Hindu mystics. I am, because I'm yet to meet the first Hindu who would tell me, and what he tells me could be authenticated. I mean, anybody can say anything they want to, but something that could be validated, that he actually discovered God within himself. And then I'd like to ask him a very simple question: what did this God look like? And that question has not been answered in Hindu philosophy. The danger is that if New Age people begin to take hold, as it seems that they are doing now, then the Christian concept of God is going to be blurred, if not put into very difficult position. And number two, what would make things very difficult is, why would you then preach Christ to anyone if all we have to do is to sit down under a banyan tree and meditate and discover God within ourselves? You don't need to have that experience of Christ coming to us. The other problem that I see is that they very plainly say that the Judeo-Christian worldview is the source of all modern problems. And in other words, they're saying that we accept Christ as one of the avatars or reincarnations of God, but the Christian ethical system is not acceptable, because that has put false limitations of human behavior. It has caused divisions, it has caused difficulties, both economic and political, and therefore we have hunger in parts of the world, there is ignorance, and is all to be attributed to the Christian ethical system. And therefore, blame the Christian ethics for the problems that the world faces. If there is famine in Ethiopia, it's because of the Judeo-Christian value system. If people die of starvation in India, that's because of the Christian value system. If there's one part of the world which is wealthier than the other, is responsibility of the Christian value system. And if this idea should catch on, I wonder what would happen to all the progress and scientific technological achievements of the modern world. Which way would they go? And I was talking to somebody who believes very strongly in this particular precept, and asked him, how does he explain a country like Japan that is not Christian but has made some monumental strides in technology and industrial achievement? And of course he answered, well, they have done that, but they are also facing huge problems because they have adopted the Christian value system. The intentions, as they are advertised, of the New Agers are to help a person solve modern problems. Now, if you see that in any advertising campaign, it's going to appeal to you. I mean, there's not a person that I've met who does not want to see things change for the better. And so this is where the appeal is, that we are going to help you to make the world a better place. We're going to help you fight personal stresses. We're going to help you fight the economic and cultural and political crises that afflict humanity today. And one group says the mega crisis. We want to find new ways to change the structures by which people live and thus create a better world. And in most of these cases, the cure begins by helping an individual discover himself, discover his own God within himself. Philosophically, the New Age foundations have three basic premises. The first premise involves the acceptance, in one form or another, of monism. Which, of course, you all know, is the philosophic doctrine that says all is one, that all things are constituted of a single reality. Now, my difficulty with that concept is, what is reality in that context? Because the Hindu thinker starts with the premise that he himself is not real, and the world that he is in is not real, because it's an illusion that he must fight and come out of. And I'm looking at it from the Hindu perspective, and I'm not quite sure if I have figured out the answer yet. How can someone who's unreal, in an environment which is also unreal, begin to explore something that is real? And yet, we have this definition which says that monism is what makes the world go. The tragedy is that this emphasis has begun to affect some of the new physics and mathematics. And you're going to hear about the new theoretical quantum physics. And there are some papers coming out of Soviet Union in mathematics which seem to point that ultimately the new physics and the new mathematics will confirm the monistic view of life, that all is one reality. This is on the scientific investigation field. On the other side, there is emphasis on meditation and planetary consciousness, working under the presupposition that all is one. If you read a book called Mysticism and the New Physics by a man called Michael Talbot, I don't know if any of you have read that book, points to that the universe is a great thought, the substance of which is consciousness. But we do not actually exist. It is stated that everything is a process, the solid world is a process. But in fact, it's only an illusion created by our own consciousness. And so under this monistic philosophy, the New Age believers have decided that they're going to deify consciousness as the monistic substate of the universe, and generally embrace the side premise that they themselves are fragments of the cosmic consciousness and therefore must possess innate divinity. The second premise is relativism and continuous change of matter and of being. Now, on one side we are saying that there is only one single reality,
But on the other, we turn around and we say, but ultimately, there is no ultimate truth. There is no personal God who has spoken. There is no one who has spoken with finality, or anyone who has arrived or has the truth or has the last word. So how does transformation and personal growth come? It comes from constant change, accommodation, and synthesis of new views. Ferguson, the lady who wrote about the Aquarian conspiracy, says the transformative methods eventually lead to the realization that there will be no ultimate answers. No one has the final answer. We are all evolving. Well, my question to Marilyn Ferguson would be, if we are all evolving and we start out being unreal, how can something that is unreal continue to evolve? And what are we evolving into? Something more unreal or something less unreal? If it is something less unreal, then are we moving towards becoming real? Or if we are becoming more unreal, how do we determine the different stages of unreality into which we are moving? And that question again is not answered. The third basic premise is individual autonomy. Social transformation will arise through transformation of the person. Each individual must have the freedom to choose for himself what he thinks best. One of the great attractions of the New Age is the freedom to live any lifestyle one desires. Marilyn Ferguson again says that we must have government by the self, for the self. Mark Satin, who is a politician, says that the New Age politics would ensure abortion rights, animal rights, the right to polygamy, the repeal of all prostitution, gambling, and drug laws. Mark Satin, who is a politician, says that the New Age politics would ensure abortion rights, animal rights, the right to polygamy, the repeal of all prostitution, gambling, and drug laws. In other words, there will be no permanent standards which are incumbent on all men everywhere. All ethics will be self-imposed. Satin goes on to say, a spiritual path is valid if it is appropriate to our needs as we ourselves define them. There's a man called Crowley who has put it this way, do what thou wilt shall be the whole law. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. The humanist imperative is an essential component of the infrastructure of the New Age thinking. There's much more, but I want to give some time if there are any questions. Professor Kibiski has said, and most of you look as if you had a long day, so I don't want to impose on your patience and your time. But New Age movement is here, whether we acknowledge its presence or not. And it poses some dangers at this point of philosophical nature, later on perhaps of practical nature. Now, I belong to a Baptist church, and unfortunately within my own church denomination, the church leadership does not see the New Age movement doing anything at all to anyone. And when I talked to the church leadership, I was told that I am getting too excited about, that's the word that was used, I'm getting too excited about something that will be here and will be gone tomorrow. I was in England in the first part of July, speaking in a math conference, and I have a friend who is a defrocked Catholic priest. And I talked to him, I've known him for a number of years. And he believes, he didn't give me any reasons for it, but he believes that the Catholic Church is very much involved in the synthesis of Christianity and Hinduism. And their rationale is that if this synthesis can be achieved for the masses, then it gives a sizable number of people of one particular persuasion to move into that camp. This man's opinion was that it may have some political overtones rather than just basic individual self-improvement and self-help. I don't know if that's true or not, and I know this being recorded, so I need to make that statement. I do not know if this is true or not, but this is what I was told by a man who's no longer a Catholic priest. I'm sure you've been following in the newspapers the happenings in California and other places in the United States. I'm sure you've heard the term the harmonic convergence. Maybe some of you have seen the attempts by Shirley MacLaine to usher in the higher self-consciousness seminars. And you can learn about higher self-consciousness and release the higher forms of energy by paying $300 and spending a weekend. They had a seminar in Chicago, cost $300, and they were expecting 200 people, but about 2,000 people showed up to learn this higher self-consciousness in a day and a half. And I really would like to meet and ask Shirley MacLaine to show me where in Hindu philosophy does it say that you can reach that higher self-consciousness in a day and a half, especially if you're dressed in Western clothing. Now, if you came in Indian-style clothing, you could sit on the floor and meditate. Possibly, you might go home with a very sore back, but not having reached the higher self-consciousness. But apparently, it's a catching thing, and the fever is spreading. Everybody wants to realize his own innate potential, and perhaps that is the biggest appeal of the movement. From power to liberate self and to achieve the impossible of the so-called visualization which is being talked about, that you can visualize what you want to achieve, and as you sit there and think about it, it will eventually happen. And all these things are beginning to attract attention, and people are dropping their traditional religious clothing and putting on these attractive new garments, hoping somehow thereby to be liberated and thus achieve the so-called cosmic union with the God within themselves, if that ever happens. That's my question, of course. With that, I'll be very happy. I don't claim to be an expert on the New Age movement, but I've been doing a great deal of reading and trying to follow the events as they unfold within our own country and across the seas. I'll be happy to take up questions in the remaining time that I have. Yes, sir. I have met several who would like to get their money back. But of course, the lists of people who participate in these seminars are very closely guarded, and it's very difficult to get hold of unless you run into someone. And so I met a man, and he was very dissatisfied. He thought the whole thing was a fraud. That's the word he used. He said the whole thing was a fraud. And he said, we were exposed to a great deal of antics by Shirley MacLaine. And that's all that happened. I mean, she sat there and she said, at one time I was a queen of Egypt, you see. And she said, I can achieve that. I can move back and see where I was. And all that. And this man was very disgusted with the whole show. But I've tried to find out and meet people who have been to the seminar, both pro and con, but I've not been able to contact people like that. I even asked the Shirley MacLaine group if they would give me the names of people who attend seminar and find out how they felt about it, what part did the seminar play in their lives. A month or two later, they have not released any names to me. Yes, sir. Well, I think the only thing I can see is that I believe there is a great deal of frustration with the organized church, especially in America. And I'm sure you experience that within the Lutheran denomination. I'm not putting anybody down, please. I see that in the Baptist churches, the organized religion is somehow not speaking to the man as it used to 200 years ago. And there's a great deal of falling away, disenchantment almost. And number two, of course, there's always the attraction for something new. And I believe the attraction for something new is coming from one is promising so much without having to give up anything. So he doesn't say you have to give up this, that, or the other. There are no conditions. Of course, once you join the group, then you recognize what the conditions are. But those conditions are not mentioned when you're being initiated into the group. But the group promises freedom. The group promises self-fulfillment. Group promises a growth in the human potential. And I believe that would be attractive to any person. If I could organize a group and I say, well, if you come and join here and spend 2 hours a day, you'll reach the top. You'll suddenly be there'll be a magical transformation in your life, and you don't have to give up anything. Actually, it'll give you more freedom, and somehow that is appealing to people, not by hundreds but thousands, especially in the Western society. France, where I went to, southern France, the New Age movement has taken over. Now that area is predominantly Catholic. And the people I talked to, the missionaries that I worked with, they all said the reason we are seeing the movement towards New Age is primarily because the Catholic Church is dead in this area. They're simply existing by going through the motions of the church. There is no substance to it. People don't get anything out of it. Whereas here comes this group, which is kind of excited, and they say, you can do this and you can achieve this. And apparently that is appealing to people. Now I know there's not, the answers are far more complex than that. But that is my immediate response to your question, sir. Yes, sir.
Most of the New Age groups practice a perfectionism.
That's right.
Reincarnation.
That's right.
So it would be an ongoing process. If I don't achieve perfection in this life,
that's right.
The next.
That's right.
Well, how do they justify that? teach it now, why do I have to go on in another life?
Okay, you see, higher consciousness is the ultimate goal. But the fact is, you don't reach that higher consciousness. So we put you on the road to reaching that higher consciousness. So the reason the reincarnation idea appeals to people is, so if you don't quite get there, well, that's not the end of the story. You can continue the process in the next life. Because what is higher consciousness is not rigidly defined anywhere. I mean, I have a notion of what that is, but I really don't know exactly when you attain that higher level of consciousness.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, they have changed from the Hindu teaching here. The Hindu teaching used to say that you could, if you don't do everything just right in the karma, in karmic interpretation of reincarnation, then you could come back in a different form of life. Okay, so you could come back as a tree or as an animal or as a fish or a bird or anything like that. Now, the new teaching is that once you have reached the human form, you cannot go back to other forms of life. And Shankara was the one who actually changed that, and that has been picked up by the New Age people. So they say, well, once you are a person, you're going to remain a person. So there is no sliding back to any other form of life.
Wait, I can see a synthesis there with purgatory. That life here on earth is really purging to reach this perfection of consciousness, the self-justification process there somewhere along the line. You're not going anywhere, you take the perfection you can't define by the consciousness. I don't know what you're being justified for.
That's exactly my point, yeah. Yes, sir.
Is this potential for higher consciousness in every person, or is this sort of a Gnostic concept that only the select few have, and other people like me who never had it, never will?
Well, you want me to answer it as a Christian or as a person who believes in the New Age? I would say if you are being initiated into the movement. Now, theoretically, I should say this to you. No, the higher consciousness is for everyone. Okay? But let's say after you are initiated into my movement, and I start giving you the exercises, the meditation, and all those kind of nice things, then I discover that you just can't do it. Theoretically, I should come back to you and say, no, it's not for you. But I would never do that because I do need you in my group. So I'm going to keep on encouraging you, saying, yes, you can reach that level of higher consciousness. But if you go back to the Hindu scriptures very definitely say that higher consciousness is not for everyone. But that is not the teaching of the New Age groups now. Yes, sir. That's right.
And I was wondering, is this something taken over from Hinduism also? Yes. I've heard that before, that in Hinduism there is this moral relativism and so on, and I've never known whether that was fair and apt to say that generally about people. I'd like to ask someone like yourself, who has been in Hinduism, whether that's so. There's a story in one of Francis Schaeffer's books where he says he was meeting with a group of students, one of whom was a Hindu, and this fellow was making that statement that ultimately there is no difference between right and wrong, good and evil. And then as kind of an object lesson, a reputation, one of the other students picked up a teapot full of steaming water and held it over the Hindu's head and said, now if there is really no difference between right and wrong, good and evil, then there is really no reason why it would be better for me not to pour this water on your head than to do it, and it shouldn't make any difference to you either. You had nothing to say in that.
Yeah, but you see, the Hindu should have said this, that for you it would make a difference because you're the one who's pouring that hot water on me. But for me, that hot water coming on me is something that I was destined to receive anyway. But to answer your question, sir, yes, Hinduism is perhaps the only religion that has no well-defined code of ethics. That's very true. The only thing that you have to be careful of is that what you're doing, and if you can be very comfortable with what you're doing, then is what is called the right action. So let's say if I steal money from you, and I feel very good about it, then that's the right action for me. I'm serious. That is exactly what the teaching would say. However, because I stole money from you, and in the process you feel bad, and you feel bad and you ascribe that badness to me, then it was not the right action for me. So that's how I decide whether it's the right thing to do or not. But let's say we both go and rob a bank, which is an it sort of a situation. And you feel good and I feel good, and the bank doesn't speak for itself. In any case, it's unreal because it's an illusion anyway. And we both feel good about it, then it's the right action for us. Am I answering your question, sir? I saw a hand there. Yes, sir. All right, Christ is one of the gods, and I believe that the Christ is appearing a little more prominently now in the New Age thinking than he used to before, primarily because they want to bring Christians into the fold. So if you can use Christ as one of the objects of higher consciousness, as one of the gods who is available, then Christians would not feel threatened and would not feel excluded because their Christ is being left out. But every New Ager would also say in the same breath that Christ is just one of the avatars, not the only sent of God.
Is Christ then just a kind of a principle? Is it the real story of Jesus, the one who lived and walked and died? Or is it just a kind of a mythological principle that they want to do?
No. Christ is like all the other gods, because you see, all the Hindu gods, Krishna, lived, had his life, and people believe in that life, which incidentally came out of an epic that another man wrote. You see, even after 5,000 years of Hinduism in India, there is still today not one single historical evidence which points to the fact that Krishna ever lived. But Hindus believe in him, all right? They believe that he lived and he did all those things that are described in that book, and he was a living reincarnation of the God, whoever that God is, who is not defined. Christ, in a similar fashion, is somebody who lived and did what he said he did, and we find the evidence in the Bible, and therefore is also acceptable as one of the gods, but no more than that. Yes.
Modern Western thinking, or let us say history of modern Western philosophy, and truth, which is one of the big issues today in the terminology of Gita. And then how about the process more to think about the part, you know, the changes and relative and something like that. Well, I can then name the number. But my question is this, how do you as a, let us say, a Christian encounter these two? Because you mentioned what are they wrong or something, which I certainly believe that they are wrong. But the point is, how would you even tackle this type of very complicated subject with, let's say, the situation in Latin America, who was present, you as you said, who are frustrated by the status quo in their religion, and now then these groups come in and use that. In my assessment, they are using Christ as a king.
Yes, right. Well, my approach is to share with the people who are being influenced by the classical Hindu thinking to point out the inconsistencies in the classical Hindu thinking. And then to say, if those inconsistencies have not been resolved after 5,000 years, how can anyone base his whole life goals on those inconsistencies? The amazing thing to me is, you see, it took me almost 3 years before I became a Christian. And it was not something that I walked down the aisle and somebody preached and I became a Christian 5 seconds. I examined the claims of Christ. And I had to be satisfied in a very mathematical, logical way that what Christ was saying and what I was being told about Christ is entirely consistent and can be validated. And once I reached that conclusion, becoming a Christian was a very easy process. However, I have not been able to establish, in spite of all my objective research, the Hindu concepts with any kind of totality of consistency. And therefore, if I can have a good, open discussion with this gentleman or whoever it might be, I can't make you see my point. But perhaps I can leave you thinking that what you've been led to believe is not based on solid foundations. And if I can achieve that, I think I've achieved a tremendous goal and my mission has been accomplished. Now, I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, I asked the question just before, what do you say, consistency and inconsistency?
Right. Well, the different arguments can be taken and they all point to the same conclusion. And you can approach it any way you want to, analyze it, break it up, study it in components, and you have to discover that there's a great deal of consistency in the whole argument. Yes. That's right. The traditional Christian message, not the Christian message that is being amalgamated or fused with the Hinduism in the New Age movement. Because it answers to any argument you can raise, any objections you can raise, any doubts you can bring, and there is a very satisfactory, consistent answer to those arguments. I'm not defending, I must point out, I'm not defending Christianity. I'm defending Christ. I'm not defending the practice of Christianity, in other words. But I'm defending Jesus Christ as the scriptures describe.
Maybe we can talk about it afterwards. Thank you very much again for your time and interest.
And we certainly thank you. My mother lives 18 miles south of Shawano, and that church used to be the largest in the Missouri Synod. And would you believe that a few blocks away is a Hindu-oriented compound, commune, guru, and you name it, so that and where do they get the adherents? Shawano County. What's Shawano County? Well, it was 96% Lutheran when I was growing up. So we can say, well, this is off, you know, and maybe in a bit of a fantasy world, or maybe Los Angeles, or someplace in Oregon, or whatever. And you know it's very real in the Midwest, and not just Chicago, but Shawano, Wisconsin. So we thank you for stimulating our own awareness of things that are going on, and what a mission world we have to the cults and to Hindu-based, philosophically-based, so-called religious and self-help groups.